Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on March 21st, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the National Popular Vote Plan. My name is Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're providing four experts to discuss our topic. Each speaker will make opening remarks of about 5 to 7 minutes, after which we'll take questions from the call-in audience. Their full bios are available on our website, so my introductions today are going to be extremely brief, and will be in the order in which they'll speak. We're going to hear first from Tara Ross, author of Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College. Second, we'll hear from Dr. John Koza, who's co-author of Every Vote Equal, A State-Based Plan for Electing the President by National Popular Vote. Third, we'll hear from Trent England, who's Vice President of Policy of the Freedom Foundation. And finally, we'll hear from Professor George Edwards of Texas A&M University. We're going to give Ms. Tara Ross a couple of extra minutes to describe the National Popular Vote Plan, after which she'll make her substantive comments. So with that, Tara, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Great. Thank you, Dean. I'm happy to be here today. Hi, everybody. It has fallen to me to explain the National Popular Vote Plan very quickly before we start discussing whether the National Popular Vote or the Electoral College is a better way to run our presidential election system. I know John will do a better, more complete description of his proposal when he comes up next. In short, the National Popular Vote Plan, they propose that states change the way that they allocate their electors. Currently, most states allocate their electors to the winner of the state popular vote. There are two exceptions to this rule, but most states do it winner-take-all. National Popular Vote would like to change this. Instead of allocating electors to the winner of the national the state popular vote, they would do the national popular vote. And they propose to do this through an interstate compact so that any state does not have to make this decision by itself. It can join with other states and all do it together at the end. The compact goes into effect when states holding a majority of electors have all agreed to the plan. I am going to address real quickly why I think this is a bad way to get rid of the Electoral College. I know my colleague Trent England is coming later, and he will discuss why the Electoral College is a good thing in general. So don't assume that I think getting rid of the Electoral College is great, is a good thing. I think it's horrible, but I will discuss why this particular method is a bad idea. NPV claims that their proposal is best because, quote, every vote should be equal. Ironically, their proposal would make voters even more unequal than they are perceived to be today. And let me try to explain why. Currently, our presidents are elected in a process that blends Federalist and Democratic principles. America holds 51 completely separate, purely Democratic elections each presidential election year, one in each state plus D.C. Local election laws impact the manner in which each of these elections is held, but any differences among the election codes don't matter. The unique laws of any particular state impact only voters within that state. The country has 51 completely separate elections, and it achieves 51 different sets of results. Each state simply wants to elect its own slate of electors. NPV would change this. We would still hold 51 separate elections, but NPV would attempt to derive one single result from these 51 different processes. There is no way that voters can be more equal in this process. They will be more unequal. Let's consider some examples of this. Consider early voting. Voters in a state like Connecticut might have one set of laws regarding early voting. Other states might have different provisions regarding when it starts, how long it lasts, how do you vote, can you vote through the mail or not, how does this work? These differences in laws do not matter when Connecticut voters are participating in their own election only against themselves, but if you start throwing Texans into the mix with a whole different set of early voting laws, then you start to see how people can be treated unequally. They have different amounts of time to vote, different ways to do that through the mail, et cetera. States have many other differences in how they operate their elections. They may differ in whether they allow felons to vote. They may differ in what they require before a candidate can qualify for the ballot. They differ in what triggers a recount. They differ in how they count a hanging chad, which mattered a lot in one state in 2000. Imagine if it's all over the country. But these logistical difficulties are just the tip of the iceberg. There are other political and legal problems with the compact that has been proposed. First, let's do the political. MPV's compact can't create stability in our presidential election process. It is too easy to join and unjoin their compact as opposed to a constitutional amendment, which would be a relatively permanent solution. So imagine this year that MPV has just enough states to be operable. The campaigns are proceeding on the assumption that a national direct election will control in November. But in late June, Massachusetts gets worried that Mitt Romney is going to win the national popular vote. That's kind of ironic. I just realized it was Romney in Massachusetts. In disgust, this legislature decides to pull out of the interstate compact. They've done this type of thing in other contexts with Senate seats, as you might recall, so it's not unimaginable. Suddenly, MPV no longer has enough states on board to proceed with its plan. The country is again hosting a normal presidential election with the Electoral College in place. Well, unless something like Texas decides to jump in, hold a special session, change its mind, and join the compact, and then we're back where we started. This kind of flip-flopping back and forth is not good for the stability of our country. Second, there's legal problems, which would take me way too long to discuss, so I will do my best to highlight the key points. MPV relies upon an interstate compact, as John will describe in more detail later. MPV claims that its compact is perfectly appropriate and that it would not require congressional consent, despite the language in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, which says, "No state shall, without the consent of Congress, enter into any agreement or compact with another state." Now, he's correct that the Supreme Court has unfortunately strayed from a strict reading of that clause and has been a bit too lenient, in my view, in allowing compacts to stand even without congressional approval. But even taking these new lenient measures, it is hard to see how this compact can stand without approval from Congress. The relevant standard is found in United States Steel Court versus Multi-State Tax Commission. In that case, the court held that the compact in question was valid because it did not enhance the political power of the member states in a way that encroaches upon the supremacy of the United States. The test, the court held, is whether the compact enhances state power with respect to the national government. Now, MPV claims there is no increase in state power. It notes that states already have the power to allocate their electors in any method they choose. Thus, the federal government is not impacted, they say. Their logic fails for two reasons. First, MPV conveniently forgets that its compact does impact the political balance between federal and state governments, if for no other reason than that the federal government has an important interest in protecting its constitutional amendment process. Second, MPV prefers to forget that the U.S. Steel Court also briefly acknowledged another test. It acknowledged that impacts on sister states could impact their analysis of whether approval is required. A compact implicating the federal structure, quote, it said, could be problematic. Now, non-compacting states have important interests at stake here. One, they have a right under the Constitution's amendment process to participate in any decision made about changing the nation's presidential election system. They are deprived of these protections, or the compact would deprive them of protections provided by the supermajority requirements of Article 5. Finally, the voting power of states relative to other states is changed. Now, MPV is the first to bemoan the fact that every vote is not equal in the presidential election and that the weight of a voter's ballot depends on the state in which he lives. If they equalize voting power through their compact, they are by definition increasing the political power of some states and decreasing the political power of other states. This would seem to require approval for their compact from Congress. There are other issues that will need to be addressed if their compact is approved by a critical mass of states. I have like 45 seconds left, so I will blow through them. But MPV relies on the plenary power of state legislatures to select the manner in which its state will appoint electors. Is this power really without limit? In U.S. Term Limits versus Thornton, Justice Thomas said, states may establish qualifications for the delegates to the Electoral College if they pass muster under other constitutional provisions. Does MPV pass muster under Article 5, which requires supermajorities to amend the Constitution? There are other notable cases in which the court has struck down statutes that were said to upset the compromises struck and the delicate balances achieved during the Constitutional Convention. I'll just highlight one statement by Justice Stevens, where he remarked in U.S. Term Limits that a state provision with the avowed purpose and obvious effect of evading the requirements of the qualifications clauses cannot stand. To argue otherwise is to suggest that the framers spent significant time and energy in debating and crafting clauses that could be easily evaded. I would propose that NPV does exactly that and that it will not stand. And I'm out of time.
Well, thank you very much. Let's turn now to Dr. John Koza, your opening remarks.
Well, thank you, Dean. So the National Popular Vote Bill is a state bill in state legislatures that is based on Article 2 of the Constitution, Section 1, which says that each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct the number of electors. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that that power is an exclusive power of the states and is a plenary power of the states, contrary to what Tara Ross was just suggesting, that somehow the federal government has some interest in it. In fact, this is a unique power and differs from the state power to regulate congressional elections, which is shared with Congress. So what is the purpose of this bill? The purpose is to deal with the fact that our presidential elections exclude virtually two-thirds of the voters of the country. The reason is the winner-take-all rule, which awards all of the state's electoral votes to the candidate who gets the most votes inside that state, so that if a candidate is comfortably ahead or hopelessly behind, they ignore that state. So in practice, that means that two-thirds of the campaign visits in the general election and two-thirds of the money go into six states, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, and a couple of others. 98% go into 15 states, and 200 million out of 300 million Americans are ignored. Now, one remedy was proposed by Erich Fleischer. He says if people don't like it, they can move from a safe state to a swing state. But we think a better solution is simply to add up the votes from all 50 states, and the candidate with the most votes would then be assured under the compact enough electoral votes to have the keys to the White House. Now, Tara says that far from making votes equal across the country, equally important, they make votes unequal, and she cites early voting and a different treatment of felons. 13 states don't allow ex-felons to vote. She says that differences do not matter. That's a quote. And, quote, they impact only voters in that state. Well, that's not true. The fact that Ohio doesn't have photo ID this year will impact the entire country because closely divided battleground states such as Ohio, which got 62 of the 300 post-convention visits, may well determine who's president, as it did in 2004. And similarly, the other big, closely divided battleground states, Pennsylvania and Florida, played the same role. So like a lot of the objections to a national popular vote, the objections apply to the current system in an equal or, in some case, worse a degree. In fact, every vote would be equal. You're going to add them up the same way you vote for governor, and the candidate with the most votes would win. In terms of stability, the compact applies to any election where a majority of states possessing a majority of the electoral votes are in the compact on July 20th. Nobody is going to leave this compact. Most recent poll I saw was 83% support a popular vote in Tennessee, and it polls in the mid-70s across the country and from state to state. So the permanence comes from the fact that the people want this. It is difficult to get states to pass this. So far, 9 states have passed it with half the electoral votes that's needed to put into effect, and we hope it will be in effect by 2016. But the fact is the stability comes from the fact that the current system simply has very little justification and certainly almost no popular support. So sooner or later, the current system will collapse. I'm glad Tara Ross said the Supreme Court has strayed. concerning congressional consent, we can sit and argue whether it's needed or not. No doubt the courts will weigh in at some point and tell us whether it's needed or not. But the current constitutional law is that an interstate compact does not require congressional consent unless it threatens federal supremacy. Now, since the power to award electoral votes is an exclusive state power, there's no threat to federal supremacy. And as for impact in other states, we don't believe there's any argument that there is unfavorable impact, but Tara didn't mention that that particular test was advocated by one justice in an otherwise unanimous upholding of the longstanding rule going back to 1893 that interstate compacts do not require congressional consent. However, if it requires congressional consent, we'll have to go get it. And remember, this will be at a point when approximately half the states will have enacted it, and again, 70 or 80% of the public will want it. So I think that's a side issue. I believe I'm pretty much out of time, so I'd just like to say that many of the objections you're going to hear about national popular vote revolve around hypothetical scenarios where we have actual evidence of what happens in the real world. Tara Ross, for example, testified that we could get a president elected by 15% of the vote. Well, we could get a governor elected by 15% of the vote, but we know from actual experience in the real world that in governor elections for the chief executive of the state, going back to World War II, only 10% were under 50%, only 1% were under 40, and none were under 35. So while this is a theoretic possibility, the fact is it's a theoretical possibility under the current system, because, of course, no state requires an absolute majority of the popular votes to obtain the state's electoral votes. And as we well know from 4 out of 56 presidential elections, there's no requirement that the person who becomes president have received a majority of the popular votes nationwide. Thank you very much, Dean, and look forward to the rest of the conversation.
Of course. Let's turn now to Trent England. Trent, your opening remarks?
Yes. Thank you, Dean, and thanks to the Federalist Society for putting this together. I'm going to talk about why I believe the Electoral College is important. And, you know, one of the ways to think about this, I've traveled around and talked with lots of state legislators about this issue. Most of the complaints and confusion cited by National Popular Vote and by people who are frustrated with the Electoral College relate to the U.S. Senate as well. And it's one of the things, I guess one of the benefits of being interested in the Electoral College before National Popular Vote came on the scene and before even the 2000 election, when you look at much of the literature that's been written against the Electoral College, it also is associated with arguments that the U.S. Senate should be abolished, perhaps that we should have a parliamentary system, that our system of states and federalism is somehow backward. I don't believe any of those things, but I do believe that there's a consistency to advocating all of them together, and I'm going to discuss, I think, partly why all of that is wrong. It's important to remember when we talk about electing the President of the United States, this is this is the position that people call the leader of the free world. You know, pick your favorite metaphor, the finger on the button, the 3 a.m. phone call. This is an office that's not like any other office, both in its real and its perceived importance. And the election is therefore not like any other election. And comparing it to a governor's race, the states are all much smaller than the entire country. We live in a profoundly diverse nation. It has been really since the very beginning, and it's a very large nation. And so having an electoral college system allows us to prevent some of the worst results that can come about and have come about in large areas and diverse peoples when they've directly elected their heads of state. And oftentimes people say, well, you know, we're the only country with an electoral college. That's sort of a half-truth. We're the only country with our electoral college. But, of course, many countries are parliamentary. That's arguably less democratic, less representative. And India has an electoral college system. They call it that. There are actually very few countries, especially very few large, diverse, and stable countries that have anything like a direct election for an office that is comparable to the President of the United States. The Electoral College does not work as the founders thought it would, not precisely, but I think it works much better. I think that if the American founders came back and looked at the way the Electoral College works today, I think they'd be very impressed. And it's important to note that almost always, the Electoral College corresponds with the popular vote, and it generally works to amplify the popular vote, which is to decrease the likelihood of election disputes and also controversies over the legitimacy of the presidency. Four elections are often cited as having come out the wrong way, and I'm surprised that we haven't heard that yet, but maybe we will. 1824, 1876, 1888, and 2000. And 1824, there wasn't actually a national vote for president, so that's a particularly illegitimate example. But I'd like to talk about the other three, because I believe particularly two of these elections were the greatest achievements of the Electoral College. In 1876, the Hayes-Tilden race, what happened essentially was that there was racist vote suppression in the South that threatened to sway the election. And because the Electoral College makes our presidential election a state-by-state election, it uses states like the watertight compartments on an ocean liner to isolate election problems and allow them to be resolved. And I think certainly, regardless of any other arguments and analysis of that election, 1876 came out the right way. At least it wasn't racist vote suppression that swayed the election. You think about if the Democrats had won their first presidential race after the Civil War through racist vote suppression, that would have been a pretty bad message to send in American politics. The Electoral College prevented that from happening, and I think that the outcome, while imperfect, was better than it would have been if there was a direct popular election. There's almost no question that the vote suppression would have worked to its intended effect. 1888, even better example, Grover Cleveland running for re-election, and Cleveland learned the lesson of what the Electoral College does, not just in a presidential race, but to national political strategy, to the formation of political parties that then cascades down to the most local level. If you're involved in partisan politics, you understand that how the parties are organized at the top profoundly influences how they're organized at the bottom. And our political parties are large coalitions. They're not even political parties in the way that the American founders used that term. They're large coalitions constantly struggling to get to 50% plus one. And in 1888, the Democrats were able to reach 50% plus one in the popular vote. But it was through a coalition that had slipped. Cleveland had originally won in 1884 with a broader, more national coalition. It slipped back to relying more on intense popularity in the Deep South. The Electoral College said that's not enough. And it really forced the nation's politics after that election to return to being national and also to be more moderate, because it created an incentive for the Democrats to ignore the most radical elements of their own coalition and reach more into the North, into the new Western states. That's a good thing for our politics. The Electoral College creates positive incentives that, while no election system is perfect, it creates the incentives that make us more stable, more national, more moderate than we would be under any kind of a national direct election scheme, and I think particularly under a scheme like national popular vote that is so uncertain and would throw so many disputes into the federal courts. With that, I will surrender my last 10 seconds and look forward to questions in a few minutes.
Thank you very much. Professor George Edwards, your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean, and I'm delighted to be here. We have to begin with the proposition that central to democracy is equality in voting. And I think we have to evaluate any scheme for selecting officials against it. And we know that the Electoral College does indeed allow us to elect the candidate who does not receive the most votes. And since we have the unit rule in most states, it not only suppresses the votes of the minority because we can't aggregate them across the country, but it also may suppress the votes of the majority. For example, in 1992, Bill Clinton won 40% of the vote in Colorado, got 100% of the state's electoral votes, which is a gross misrepresentation of the views of the people of Colorado. If no candidate receives a majority of the electoral vote, it goes to the selection goes to the House of Representatives, where every state has one vote. So it would be possible for the seven members of the House representing the seven smallest states with a combined population of about 4.9 million people to outvote 177 members of the House representing the six largest states with a combined population of 119 million people. This is the most egregious violation of democratic principles in American politics. I know of no one, actually, who will defend that. Well, the question then becomes, are there compensations from the Electoral College for these violations of democratic principles? And I think it's pretty clear that they're not. Let me go right to the heart of one of the most common arguments made, and you just heard Trent make it, that somehow the Electoral College forces candidates to put together broad majorities, sometimes called concurrent majorities across the country. There's simply no evidence to support this assertion. Candidates don't even try to obtain a concurrent majority because of the Electoral College. The Electoral College discourages this. For example, in the last presidential election, the winner, Barack Obama, campaigned in 14 states, representing 33% of the population. This is a very representative of the pattern. I've gone through the general election campaigning of election after election after election, candidates of both parties, vice presidential candidates. It's very, very common. Between them, the two presidential candidates in 2008 personally campaigned in only five of the 29 smallest states. But they also bypassed the large states, Washington, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Georgia, California, Texas, Illinois. They never showed up once. New York saw a single McCain event because he had to be there for another reason. So the candidates avoid entire regions of the country, as anyone who actually follows electoral politics knows. Now, it's possible the candidates could compensate for their visits by where they advertise. But fortunately, now we know every single advertisement the candidates run, and their advertising mirrors their campaign appearances. Moreover, we also know what candidates say when they go to wherever they go. And we know that they don't focus on building coalitions by addressing local issues. They simply don't do that. Indeed, it's difficult to imagine how presidential candidates could be less attentive to developing, forging a broad coalition, concurrent majorities. They simply don't. We have lots and lots of evidence for this. There's no evidence on the other side. But, of course, even if candidates don't try to get a concurrent majority, maybe they actually obtain one anyhow. So do they actually do this? Well, we know, of course, that Democrats win in certain areas of the country, the Northeast, the West Coast, the Upper Midwest, and Republicans win the South, the Mountain States, and the rural Midwest. So they don't get majorities from across the country. But maybe we could look at social strata. Forget geography for a moment, and let's look at social strata. Now, we can take 2000, where the Electoral College really made a big difference on who won the election. So let's see what George Bush won and didn't win. Well, we know that he did not win a larger percentage than Al Gore of the votes of the following groups: women, blacks, Hispanics, Asian Americans, the elderly, the poor, members of labor unions, those with high school education or less, those with postgraduate education, Catholics, Jews, liberals, moderates, urbanites, those with less than $50,000 of household income, young voters up to 29, voters over 60, in addition to those living in the East and the West. It simply strains credulity to claim that his vote represents winning concurrent majorities across the major strata of American society. The Electoral College discourages that. And, of course, candidates are not fools, so they play by the rules the Electoral College sets up. Now, there's also no evidence at all that the Electoral College is more likely to encourage moderation than with direct election of the president. The Electoral College didn't prevent blatant class appeals by candidates on the left, such as FDR in 1936 or Harry Truman in 48, nor did it prevent the election of ideologues of the right, such as Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. These and others were very polarizing elections, and the last election was an extraordinarily polarizing election, in which differences of opinion among the coalition supporting the candidates were very considerable. Let me say something about the party system. It's often said that if you had direct election, it would fragment the party system. But that's not true. And that's one of the things that we know best about politics. It's one of the things that political scientists have the firmest views on. And that is, if you don't have a runoff, and we don't need to have a runoff, then actually direct election of the president discourages third parties because there's no prize to win. You have to come in first or you get nothing. And we know a lot about two-party systems. The Electoral College, on the other hand, provides incentives for third parties and fragmentation of the party system because you can win states. And then you can help fragment the party system. And that's exactly, for example, what George Wallace wanted to do. He wanted to win some states which would give him leverage in the selection of the president. So what actually happens, in the absence of a runoff, there's no question that direct election discourages third-party candidates. And the Electoral College encourages them. Now, there's another thing that the Electoral College does regarding third parties, and I think it's really important for us to understand. Under the Electoral College, a third party can tip the balance in a closely contested state by siphoning a few votes from the majority party candidate and actually distort the views of the people within that state. There's little question, in fact, there's no question, that Ralph Nader cost Al Gore the election in 2000 because of the votes he siphoned from Gore in New Hampshire and in Florida. We have elaborate data on this. And it's quite clear that the preferred candidate in both of those states among the two candidates was Gore and not Bush. That doesn't make Gore better. I'm not advocating for Gore per se. But the real point is that it distorted the views of the public, and they did not cast the electoral votes for the candidates they preferred. Now, let me say one other thing about fraud, and then I'll end. The argument is that somehow the Electoral College isolates fraud and other voting problems. First of all, we have very, very, very little voting fraud in national elections, not just presidential elections, but senatorial elections, House elections. We've had a number of commissions look into this. They simply can't find any systematic fraud. Most fraud is at the local level, races for like sheriff. But at any rate, think about what the Electoral College actually does. It magnifies the consequences of fraud because you can steal a few votes, let's say in Florida in 2000, a few votes and determine the outcome of the election. You'd have, if you were going to change the outcome of a national vote total, and you'd have to have, stolen 1,000 times more votes. Instead of 538, you've had to stolen 540,000 votes. And it's much more likely that a state is going to have a very close vote than the nation. And we actually have all kinds of mathematical models that have been run on that. So again, that's something we know a lot about. Well, at any rate, so there are not compensations that the Electoral College gives us for violating democratic principles, and that's why I favor direct election of the president and the abolition of the Electoral College.
Okay, thank you. Let's go back through our order very quickly, just for 60 seconds of response from each one of our panelists, beginning with Tara Ross.
Okay, John said something about I am citing one justice in the U.S. Steele opinion. I will just note for the record, it was the majority opinion on page 477 to 78, where they did imply definitely that impacts on states would be considered. It just was not a point in that particular case. George said many things about swing states and the impacts, and I will just note briefly that historically, swing states change all the time, and so I know these statistics are cited very often, but if you really look at the history of states' voting, what you see is there's no such thing as a permanently safe or a permanently swing state. Texas used to vote Democrat. California used to vote Republican. Enough said. My last point for him, George said something about it's easier to steal votes with the Electoral College because it only takes a few votes to change the outcome. But really, in real life, you have to predict where those votes are going to matter. Nobody knew ahead of time that a few votes in Florida in 2000 was going to make a difference. So nobody was going out there making a point of stealing those votes. But if for some reason you are able to predict that, think Ohio 2004, where maybe some thought that was going to happen, then everybody and their mother is out there also defending the state because they're expecting the very same fraud. And it is much, much harder to do what you're trying to do.
Don Koza, your response?
Well, I recently debated Trent England in Utah, and it was literally 100 years, 1912, since the state of Utah was within 8% and could even remotely have been considered a gettable state by another candidate. The point is, yes, Texas did flip over from being Democratic to Republican in 1968, and it stayed Republican since. The fact is, a vote in Texas doesn't matter now. Maybe once in the Texan's life, maybe once in George Edwards' life, his vote mattered if he lived in Texas that time. The fact is, it is not good for the country to have a political system where 200 million of 300 million Americans are left out of the process.
Trent England.
Well, I think that elections are about more than sort of a self-esteem project for the voters. The fact that that margins are wide and even predictable in some races around the country is hardly a result of the Electoral College. Every governor's race is winner-take-all. I didn't get half a Dino Rossi in 2004 in Washington State. And you know, you find people all around the country in single-member districts who say, my vote doesn't matter. You know, in a certain sense, they're right. In a certain sense, they're not right. But it hardly seems like enough justification to turn the entire nation into a single-member district for president and completely wipe away state lines from presidential campaigns. The suggestion that it doesn't moderate our politics just flies in the face of the historical examples, right? Not theoretical examples, but the actual history. As we have seen, it's simply common sense. When a candidate or a strategist looks at the political map, they don't go to states where they have 70% popularity and try to drive it up to 85%. They go to states where they have 48% popularity and they try to get it up to 52%. Right? That is much healthier, especially over time, beyond any individual election, but over time, as our politics develop and change, driving the national campaigns and the national parties to places that are evenly divided is very beneficial to both our stability and moderation. It also means that where election disputes do arise, there's the greatest political accountability because these are states that are evenly divided and both parties tend to control some of the levers of power rather than having election disputes in places like Chicago and Los Angeles where there's one party control and very little that a voter in Texas or a voter in Vermont could do to know that elections there are verifiably secure.
And George Edwards, a very brief response.
Okay, sure. First of all, the fact that a state may be a swing state 20 years from now is irrelevant to the argument made on behalf of the Electoral College, which is that it forces candidates in any given election to reach widely and to get a broad coalition. It doesn't matter. That's simply illogically irrelevant. Second, because votes don't matter in states like Texas, where I live, it discourages turnout. If you want to build party systems, and if you want to stimulate the development of party systems, if you want to stimulate voter participation, then you got to have elections where things matter. Right now, the Republicans and the Democrats will not put a nickel into Texas and developing the party in this election because they already know what the outcome is going to be. That's not good for the political system. That's very bad, and it's because of the Electoral College. Now, finally, that we have to look, if we're going to look at encouraging moderation, what Trent just argued was that, well, you go to states that are competitive, which of course you do, and ignore most of the country. I don't know why that can be good, but at any rate, and then somehow that turns you into a moderate when you're fighting for that vote. There's simply no evidence of that. There's no evidence of that at all. We have lots of studies of party systems. We have tons of studies of elections, and there's not a shred of evidence to support that assertion.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all for your first thoughts on this important topic. Let me ask a question to get us started here. I think it was noted that Interstate Compact is not implicated here because there's no issue of federal supremacy. Let me ask the legal question. Has the federal government expressed some form of federal supremacy through the Voting Rights Act, in particular Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires, I think it covers now 17 states or parts of 17 states. Would those states need to get preclearance from the Department of Justice or from the D.C. District Court before adopting utilizing the National Popular Vote Plan? And if that's true, is that a form of federal supremacy that would require the entire plan to get congressional approval? So I direct that question to anybody who wants to answer it.
Well, this is Trent. I would think so. In particular, in a state that is covered, and this may be probably most of the covered states, where the percentage of the minority groups is larger than their percentage in the nation as a whole. I think there's at least an argument that their impact in the election would be diminished, and that therefore preclearance would be required. And I haven't looked in detail at the second part of your question, but I think that's at least likely. And furthermore, if these questions are going to be resolved by federal courts, federal Department of Justice, there's no reason to think that they would be in a hurry to surrender their role in a process like this that if it ever did happen would have tremendous ramifications for our national politics.
Well, I can just say that the National Popular Vote Bill has already received preclearance from the Department of Justice as a result of California's enactment, because California is one of the states that are required to have preclearance.
Okay. Anybody else? That was John Koza, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was supposed
no
to
problem.
Identify myself.
No problem. Tara Ross or George Edwards, do you want to weigh in on this question?
Just say it got preclearance from the Department of Justice just because California decided to adopt it? Nobody's challenged that yet, so that would presumably be still a subject of challenge. That's the first time I've heard that.
Well, it's required to get preclearance within a certain amount of time. I believe it was 90 days, but I'm not sure of it. But all of that has happened.
I don't claim to be an expert on Voting Rights Act, just with that qualification. I would not think that just because California decided to spontaneously do something that it was supposed to get preclearance for, and it just didn't do it, that doesn't mean that they were right or that
California
can't be challenged.
California did ask for preclearance as required by law, and they got it last fall.
They got preclearance for NPV last fall?
Yes.
Specifically?
It's on our website.
I don't check your website every day.
California is not as a state, though, is not a covered jurisdiction under Article and under Section 5, I don't believe.
This is the first time I've heard any of this.
It certainly is, and if you go to our website, nationalpopularvote.com, you'll find it headlined on the first page.
Now, there are four counties in California that are covered.
I think it's interesting, okay, so this is the first time I've heard this, but I think it's interesting that you're just speaking very casually about California getting preclearance, and if they need preclearance, then it does mean that voting power was changed in that state, and which means it'll change in other states, which kind of goes back to my point that, if we're going to pretend like there's no impact on non-compacting states, when clearly we're changing voting power of voters all across the country. Again, NPV is the first to say a vote in Texas or a vote in Oklahoma or whatever does not have the same weight. Clearly, this is something that means that we have to go get congressional approval because we are changing the political balance of power among the states.
Well, Tara, this is John Koza again, and I'm sure the audience has other questions. As you correctly said when your first presentation, you think the Supreme Court has strayed. They strayed in 1893 when they set the criteria for interstate compacts. But having said that, this bill has huge popular support in the 70-80% level. And if by chance the Supreme Court changes its mind, then we'll have an extra step to go through. But there is no argument that when every vote is added up across all 50 states, that somehow voters are being treated unequal, and that's what the Voting Rights Act was about.
Well, I think if you have such huge popular support, then you should just go get the constitutional amendment, and we can, you know, have done with all this controversy about whether MPV is constitutional or not.
Okay, but this is Dean Reuter. It does look like we have some audience questions lined up, so if you don't mind, we'll move to that first question from the audience.
This is John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's go back to the original functional intent of the Electoral College, and I submit to the forum that we should not want to elect a candidate that has popular support. We should not want a candidate elected that would seek such support, and we do not want a election process in which money may be effectively spent to influence that decision. That the way to go is to correct the process for electing electors and to go in each state to a multi-phase sortition process, not an election, a random selection process with filtering in between each round of random selection that would be similar to the system used for 760 years by the city-state of Venice to select their doge. That system worked very well up until the time that Venice was conquered, and it selected individuals who had important characteristics. They were not under the control of any of the major interest groups. And we should be seeking a president who is the most qualified individual who doesn't want the job and who does not represent any interest group.
Okay. Who wants to respond to that? Any of our panelists?
Well, I don't agree with that. This is Trent England, but I think that there's a point there that the executive, I mean, we have drifted so far from understanding the different roles of the branches of government, and the founders' intent, and I think this is clearly a good thing, was to find an executive who could do the job. And that does mean the power comes from the people, but it comes from the people through the states. And it was actually a Democratic legislator in Massachusetts who pointed out a few years ago that national direct election will only tend to aggrandize the executive even more within our system. And he didn't think that was a good thing. And I think that's right. I think that, this idea that one person can represent in any real meaningful way 300 million people, it's a fiction, and I think that the French experience suggests that it's a dangerous fiction.
Anyone else want to weigh in on this point?
I think we should move to another question.
Do that. Go right ahead, caller.
Can you discuss the potential impact national popular vote would have on election administration and state election laws if there were a close election and there had to be a recount, especially if you had to apply the principles of Bush v. Gore across every district in the nation?
Well, I think this is one of the...
John Koza, I'd just like to comment concerning recounts. One of the previous speakers said, quote, it decreases the likelihood of election disputes. The current system does exactly the opposite. In our nation's history, it's only 56 presidential elections. There have been 5 litigated state counts, the most recent being Bush versus Gore, the second most recent being the Hawaii 1960 recount. Compare that to the infrequency of disputed elections and recounts in ordinary elections in which the candidate with the most votes wins. And the answer is, and there's been a study of several thousand statewide elections going back several decades, is that the chances of a recount and a dispute are 1 in 160. The reason the current system does so badly and creates these unnecessary artificial crises, such as Florida in 2000 and the Tilden Hayes race and the Cleveland race, is that every election is 51 separate elections, And therefore, we've had not 56 presidential elections since 1789, but roughly 2,200. And that's why we've had five litigated state counts. A key point is that the possibility of recount would be substantially less under a single pool of votes than it is when every election is 51 separate votes.
So, John, though, just to be clear, you are suggesting that 1876 and 1888 would have been better if they would have come out the other way.
Well, I'm in favor of having the president elected by a popular vote of the people in all 50 states.
I think that really is the issue. I mean, in 1876, I'm glad that we had a system that was able to prevent racist vote suppression from stealing the election, and NPV sees that as a travesty.
No, NPV is not in support of that, and that's your characterization of it. But the cause of the dispute is not at issue here. What I'm talking about is the frequency of dispute.
You're talking about whether the dispute could be addressed at all, and suggesting it would have been better under a system where it was not able to be isolated and prevented from having effect.
Well, if the current system doesn't isolate problems, it creates problems. There was no problem if you have the concept of a popular vote nationwide. There was no problem in 2000. There was no problem in 1888 that needed to be resolved. The current system doesn't isolate problems. It creates problems when there was no problem there, and creates this situation where we've had five litigated state counts in a mere 56 elections compared to roughly one in 160 disputes in ordinary elections. In presidential terms, that means we'd have a disputed presidential election once in 640 years. And at that point, there'll be a mess.
But I don't think it's that easy to draw the parallels. And we have seen extremely close and litigated statewide elections. I know you're aware of what happened in Minnesota. We've had it in Washington State. The nature of elections is that, at least under certain circumstances, they tend to be close. And I think the question gets it right. I mean, there's no answer under NPV for how practically a disputed election, an election with a razor thin margin, if that happened. I mean, I understand the argument that it may be less likely to happen, but I don't think it's a great argument. Hey, go out and do this. It's unlikely that anything will go wrong, but if something does, it'll be a total disaster. I don't know that that's really the strongest position.
I'm sorry.
You go ahead, Tara, if you can go quickly. It looks like we've got three more questions, and I want to get through those.
I'll be fast. I think NPV has jumped too quickly to the conclusion that there will not be more recounts. If you go look, Brad Smith wrote something about this, former FEC commissioner, and he said that if he went back and he looked at it and he did his count, and I will forget the exact numbers, but the essence of it was that if we'd had a direct election in place, we would have had recounts in one in every six elections, historically, just looking at pure history. And I think we also need to take into account the fact that elections will change, and we cannot assume we would have had the same outcome in 2000 with a direct election system in place. Probably there would have been more than two major contenders that election year, which would have brought the margins closer.
Okay, let's go to the next audience question.
Thank you. An argument that was made by one of your participants was that against the Electoral College was that it may not reflect the wishes of the people of the state because of third parties and perhaps winner-take-all. Winner-take-all could, of course, be changed by the states through proportional or something. But my question is, isn't that also quite possible and even perhaps likely under the popular vote, where my state of Maine, for example, could vote pretty resoundingly for a Democrat, but if a Republican won popular vote nationwide, the electors from Maine would have to go against the wishes of its people and vote for that Republican if they were party to the contract.
Who wants to respond to that?
Well, that's the whole point of the compact, is to assure that the president is the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states. So when Vermont enacted the interstate compact, they knew full well that half the time a Republican is going to win the national popular vote, and half the time a Democrat will win But you can't have it both ways. You can't have the presidential election determined by a state-by-state count at the same time as it's controlled by a national count. So when you adopt the national popular vote bill, you're agreeing with roughly 75% of the American people that the president should be the candidate who gets the most votes in all 50 states, and the state-by-state count should not control. Now, if Maine doesn't adopt the compact, that would be Maine's opinion. But Vermont has, for example, and Hawaii have decided that with the full knowledge that roughly 50% of the time going forward, their state's electoral votes won't necessarily match the national. But the advantage to them is that they're going to get some attention, and that a vote in Hawaii and Vermont and all the other states that have enacted it will matter for the first time. I mean, a vote in Texas and Hawaii and Vermont simply don't matter right now.
Sarah or Trent, anything on this point?
The short answer is yes. Maine electors will be voting against the wishes of Maine. And it's worse than that. Even if that candidate were not on the ballot in Maine at all, they would still have to do that.
Okay. Let's go to the final two questions here. Go ahead, caller.
Okay. This is Jim Markowski, a lawyer in New York. What is the response to the to what I think is the fallacy of the assertion that a handful of small states get ignored during a national election when the national popular vote plan would result in candidates focusing on a handful of large metropolitan areas, probably no more than a dozen or so, and ignore the rest of the country?
Well, such a candidate would, of course, lose the presidential election. Now, if you look at the 13 smallest states with 3 and 4 electoral votes, they have 11 million people. 12 of them are non-competitive and ignored. By coincidence, Ohio has 12 million people. Right now, Ohio gets 62 of the 300 post-convention visits, 1 in 5. Those same 11 million people in those 12 small states, they get 0. So under a national popular vote, a vote in one of those 12 small states suddenly becomes just as good as a vote in Ohio. And there's no way it would be ignored, at least by any candidate who knows how to run an election.
We can add a couple things to this. We know that the cost of advertising, which is most of a candidate's, most of a campaign and most of the budget of a campaign, is dependent on market size. And it's actually cheaper because of demand for time. It's actually cheaper to campaign and advertise in rural areas, in smaller areas rather than large metropolitan areas. So any candidate who actually wanted to win would be very smart and actually would need to advertise across the country. We would disperse advertisements rather than concentrate it as it is now. And if you took and John has a very good chart, which I'm sure he could send anyone who wants it. If you looked at the 10 or 12 largest states and just looked at the popular vote in those states for president, you would see it's pretty much a wash. So you can't just rely on those states if you have a direct election of the president or a national popular vote election of the president. You've got to go broader unless you're a really foolish candidate.
This is Trent England. I've actually run for office in a single-member district. And so my understanding of this is an academic, but it is from reality. And candidates, and the bigger the district gets, the more true this is, hire consultants and pollsters and strategists to slice and dice up the electorate according to every kind of data that you can get to figure out who to talk to, what to say to whom, who to ignore. You don't doorbell the long driveways or the houses with the big dogs. And the idea that turning the entire country into a single-member district somehow magically makes every voter, see the same number of commercials and talk to the candidates the same number of times, and, the candidates are going to be doorbelling homes in, rural Alaska, it's just preposterous. It will change how campaigns are run. There's no question of that. It will not change the fact that there are scarce resources in campaigns and that candidates will do what they think is in their best interest And frankly, the greatest fallacy of suggesting that there is some one kind of change that would happen is that there are two parties, and there are two ways that the campaigns would change. The way Republicans run would be different than the way Democrats would run, and I think it would be even more different in an NPV scheme, and I think that's one of the problems.
I think
let me interrupt there, and let's go to the final question. I know we're about to lose Trent England here at the hour, but I want to try and get this final question in, if we could.
Yes, I would. The professor Edwards said that the whole thing had to be measured against the issue of basically a one-person, one-vote rationale. I'd like to suggest that there is a national interest that can be allowed to override that, which is maintaining geographic unity. The Electoral College arithmetically forces all parties to appeal to a broad geographic range of the country. And in a country as large and diverse as the United States, I think that's an important value to maintain, even at the cost of the occasional election where there's a slight difference in the popular vote. And I remind everyone that the one time that the Electoral College failed to prevent a regional party from winning, we had a civil war.
The fact is the facts are very simple, they're very clear, and I think they're indisputable. And the candidates do not appeal to broad areas across the country. And we know that because we know every place they go. We don't have stealth campaigns for president. We know every advertisement they run, and we know everything they say when they go someplace. And we know that they ignore most of the country. As I said before, Barack Obama campaigned in 14 states. 14 states. So that representing a third of the population. So candidates do not take their case to the country. They don't. There's nothing about somehow creating a concurrent majority from multiple geographic regions or all the geographic regions. They just ignore most of the regions.
They don't lose the states they ignore, right? So apparently those people aren't as offended as you are.
The question is not whether they're offended. That doesn't matter. The question is, does it force candidates to take their case to the people? And
but
it does not do that.
But the people in these safe states who vote for those candidates apparently disagree and feel that they are represented since
we don't know anything about what they feel about the represented. We know how they vote. The argument on behalf of the Electoral College is that it forces candidates to do something. It does not do that. It forces candidates to do precisely the opposite. It forces candidates to focus their campaigns, their promises, their advertisement, their party building activities, their turnout activities on a few places. That's what it forces them to do.
I disagree, and I think a good example is West Virginia. The Democrats thought they could safely ignore West Virginia in 2000. It had been a Democratic state for forever and ever. They thought they had it. They thought they had appealed to those people. George Bush's campaign saw that, in fact, they had not covered themselves in that state and that they were losing that state, and that's why West Virginia went for George Bush that year. So, I mean, I think the point is, yes, there are some states, safe states, that in a particular year, you know, maybe you could make these arguments about how many campaign commercials are bought, but in reality, that state feels like it's pretty well represented by one of the candidates.
We don't know a single
that state, or as soon as that state no longer feels represented, it will flip, just as West Virginia did in 2000.
But that is not a justification for violating democratic principles. The argument, we have to go back to what is the argument that you make for violating democratic principles. And the argument is that somehow it forces candidates to do something. It doesn't force candidates to do something.
It forces candidates to go to the most moderate and evenly divided, evenly balanced states in the country.
They aren't necessarily the most moderate states.
They're the most evenly divided.
And let's look at the effect of that. You have the Free Trade Party and the Free Trade President George Bush going for steel quotas the first year in office. You have Medicare Part D because it's going to help the seniors in the I-4 corridor in Florida. And you have Obama with the train to nowhere between Tampa and Orlando.
John, honestly, though, I've talked to people who support national popular vote who find that argument just beyond the pale, because the idea that log rolling doesn't happen in single-member districts and those kind of campaigns just isn't true. I mean, it may well shift, but still those. I mean, it's instructive how you describe it. The I-40 corridor, I think you said, right?
I-4.
So it's not. I mean, it's not about a state. It's about a group of voters, and you will shift what groups of voters matter in campaign strategy. Will not shift the fact that certain groups of voters will matter more than others. And I think that's this idea that we're violating majoritarian principles, and therefore. We have to have a rationale. I think there's a very good rationale in sending candidates to the most evenly divided states, and I think you see it in the historical examples where, the evidence is, why did the Democrats nominate Northerners in the latter part of the 19th century for president, right? Why? Why on earth were they nominating candidates from the North in the latter part of the 19th century? And conversely, in the latter part of the 20th century, why were the Democrats trying to find Southerners to nominate, right? Trying to find people who didn't fit the stereotype of their party. It certainly had something to do, I think everything to do, with the Electoral College, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, I'm afraid, I hate to suspend this discussion, which is robust to say the least, but we're well beyond our allotted time, and I think we need to suspend the discussion, unfortunately. So we'll have to let that be the last word. I do want to thank our audience and our experts today for their participation, which has been outstanding. We are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.